Hey, I'm Josh Spiegel, host of the podcast Lunatic in the Newsroom. If you enjoy journalism that drifts into mild panic, wild overthinking, and a guaranteed nervous breakdown, Lunatic in the Newsroom is for you. It's news like you've never heard before. The only newsroom with a panic button. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and gasp in horror as the show spirals completely out of control. It's not just news, it's emotionally unstable. Lunatic in the Newsroom. Listen today.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Hot Off the Wire. In this edition of our daily news program, we feature a selection of stories covering a variety of topics. I'm Terry Lipschitz, managing editor of the National Newsroom at Lee Enterprises and your curator of news. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire through Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss daily news updates. And now, those stories from the Associated Press.
Before New York City was a place where dreamers come to make it big, before hip-hop, before the skyline, there were the Black New Yorkers who built it.
Black people have been in this city since the 1600s, shaping its culture, fueling its politics, and telling its story.
But culture never stands still. It shifts, migrates, and transforms. I'm Haya Panjwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. This City Was Black is a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the view of what it means to be Black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history. And as you'll learn throughout this podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of Black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact Black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City may be concentrated on how Black communities and other minorities thrive in the city.
Today, we're starting at the very beginning, how Black people got to New York City and where they're going now.
In the 1620s, Manhattan wasn't a city yet. It was the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. That's when the first group of enslaved Africans and Spanish arrived, brought by the Dutch West India Company to help build it. Many Africans came from West and Central Africa. At the same time, many Spanish people that were already at sea had been captured on their own ships, forced into labor to clear forests, build roads, and lay the foundations of a new home that would one day be the financial capital of the world.
Andrea Mosterman is a historian at the University of New Orleans who studies early African life in New York. She says enslaved Africans' labor was everywhere, from a protective fortress and home in downtown to the protective wall that once stood along what we now call Wall Street.
Really, for the purpose of helping develop the colony, working in agriculture, helping build the infrastructure of the city and the colony at large.
That wall wasn't just a boundary, it was also the site of New York's first official slave market. And though most slaves never gained freedom, some were free in years to come. Over the next few centuries, enslaved people gained partial freedoms, appearing in court records and gaining land grants, and even participating in the Dutch Reformed Church.
By the early 1800s, New York's Black population had grown. Many lived in Lower Manhattan on Mott Street, Five Points, and surrounding streets around the Lower East Side. After the Erie Canal opened in 1825, New York became a thriving port city, attracting foreign trade and bringing immigrant groups. They arrived from Italy and Ireland and moved to Mott Street for its cheap living and proximity to ports and city life. Overcrowding and racial violence pushed Black residents uptown.
But out of displacement came resilience. Black New Yorkers built mutual aid societies, churches, forming communities in a divided city. One of those neighborhoods was known as Little Africa in Greenwich Village. Here, they built schools, owned property, and found safety amid hostility. But as the city expanded north, so did its ambition. That brings us to one of New York's most famous landmarks, Central Park.
Long before Central Park was a weekend escape for joggers and tourists, it was home to Seneca Village. Before it was one of the first thriving Black land-owning communities in New York City, Seneca Village was not completely a place where people lived. Located on the west side of Central Park between 82nd and 89th, mainly churches and richer people lived there in what we could think of as the countryside because it was cleaner than the overpopulated, disease-ridden downtown. But because the area was empty, landowners began selling off what they considered uninhabitable land, the land that would eventually become Central Park, and Black New Yorkers bought it.
And that was significant because it represented an area that was free from the racialized violence of downtown. And the discrimination that limited opportunities for Blacks in New York City at the beginning, in the middle of the 19th century.
By 1850, over half of Seneca Village's Black residents owned property, which was five times the city average. Black people from the South who escaped and left joined for better opportunities. Land ownership meant something powerful, the ability to pass something down, a claim to belonging. But in 1857, the city cleared the land to make way for Central Park, what elites called a vision of urban improvement. Homes were destroyed, communities erased. For descendants like Andrew Williams IV, what remains is legacy.
It shows our endurance to survive and overcome during situation, as was explained during the service. You know, this is a time during slavery that it was still ongoing, yet these individuals stepped out to form their own community at a time that was probably extremely dangerous. So beyond all odds, they stood up to become a community of free people.
And when Seneca Village fell, its families scattered, some to parts of Brooklyn and the Bronx, some to New Jersey, others out of the city altogether. But their story set the stage for generations of Black migration that would shape the neighborhoods for centuries.
In the 20th century, Harlem became a cultural capital. Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn grew into a center for Black Caribbean life, and the Bronx became home to many Afro-Latinos. Mancho Lopez is a curator with the Museum of the City of New York and born in Puerto Rico.
The fact is that we all feel, and I consider myself a Black Puerto Rican, the feeling that New York City is by far a better place and affords by far better opportunities than other places, but that at the same time, the city is a difficult place.
But Black migration didn't end there. In recent decades, many have moved again, some to more affordable suburbs, others back to the South.
I think that the elephant in the room, in a way here, that could make things, it won't change the general trend, but it could accelerate it, and it probably will, is the political dynamic coming from Washington. But we're talking about Black people in general, and so that means people from the Caribbean, people from Africa. So a lot of those Black communities are also in the bucket that you can call migrants, you know, international migrants. So based on the discourse, based on the policies, based on the ICE rates that we're seeing, I feel that the whole country, not just New York, feels a lot less safe and welcoming.
It's a full circle story. The same forces that once drew people north for freedom are now pushing them out for affordability. So where are Black New Yorkers going now? Some are leaving, and others are fighting to stay. Their migration, their fight, continues to redefine what it means to belong here, in a city built by their ancestors.
Next time, we'll follow one of those stories, the life of Carmen Daniels, who spent more than four decades in New York, watching rents rise and neighborhoods disappear.
This is The City Was Black, with your hosts Jalen Green and me, Haya Pinjwani. This series is produced with guidance from AP editors Ron Bample and Aaron Morrison. Archival material from the Associated Press and the Central Park Conservancy. Special thanks to our guests, Andrea Mosterman and Jessica McLean from the Central Park Conservancy, and Mancho Lopez from the Museum of the City of New York.
For more stories about race and ethnicity, visit apnews.com.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it. asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Don't miss the deadline. File by 4/15. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees. Only available with TurboTax experts.
So where are we headed right now?
Gonna go through just through the street so you see the different areas. And you wanted to go to where I started living?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll do that before we go to, because it's all on the way.
Hi, I'm Haya Panchwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. Welcome back to The City Was Black, a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the point of view of what it means to be black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history. And as you'll learn throughout this podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City will depend on how black communities and other minorities survive in the city. Last episode, we spoke about how black people got to the city. For some, it was early in the 17th century. But Carmen Daniels migrated from Guyana to New York City when she was 33 years old. 42 years later, she's living in East New York. Jalen drove around with her for a day.
Before Carmen moved from Guyana, she was a school teacher. She taught there for over a dozen years, living with her husband and 9-year-old daughter until around 1982. During that time, Guyana's economic crisis made it difficult for people to access food, including Carmen.
I could not find enough to feed my child with because food items were unavailable.
New York City has always been a place where people come searching for a better life. Carmen may not have realized it at first, but when she came to New York in 1983, her first apartment in Crown Heights was home to a large West Indian population.
And that's just one example. Since the early 19th century, Jewish communities from Russia and Poland, alongside immigrant groups from Germany, Ireland, and England, began settling in different waves across the city. They formed tight-knit communities across the five boroughs, raising families and combining their traditions into daily life. That helped transform New York into the cultural melting pot it's known as today.
Moncho Lopez is the curator with the Museum of the City of New York.
From Mali, from Niger, from Nigeria, from the Ivory Coast, from Senegal, that they're moving into the city, particularly to the Bronx. Many of them my neighbors in Mott Haven in the South Bronx, but also to Harlem.
But when she got here, Carmen searched months for work, finding it increasingly difficult to get a teaching job.
I had to go back to school, and I used to be so upset because they would say to me, oh, you know your job. It's like you're looking at somebody who's been in the system for 17 years, and I came here, I've been a teacher for 17 or 18 years already. And you're telling me I look like I know my job.
In the mid to late 19th century, many immigrants took unskilled jobs in street construction, docks, factories, and sanitation. Most found work through informal networks of family, neighbors, or others from the same hometown or ethnic community. Carmen told us that while getting her teaching license, she worked for a construction company in the Bronx making $250 a week, which, at the time, when her rent was $213 per month for her apartment, was manageable. But Carmen longed for a house for herself and her family.
Around the 1970s, New York was close to running out of money after pouring massive funds into its urban renewal projects, and businesses started moving out of the city. As the city tightened its budget, public spending cuts led to fewer affordable housing developments, deteriorating schools, and declining city services. This lack of funding emptied out neighborhoods, especially in the Bronx, Brooklyn, and parts of Queens, causing an increase in crime and homes to become very cheap.
This eventually brought new economic growth as rich newcomers came into the city. but it also set the stage for a new wave of urban revitalization. By the 1990s, Manhattan was booming again, and housing prices surged as new businesses came through the 2000s and 2010s.
All kinds of stores popped up. Latte store, getting the same deli that wasn't serving nothing but cold cuts and bread. Started to have make your own salad, fresh.
Do you think that's made the neighborhood worse?
No, it has made the neighborhood better, but why couldn't it be done when we were living there is the question I ask all the time. Why we don't get that kind of service? Even the grocery stores, we should see the difference.
As real estate increased and gentrification grew, the money from Carmen's teaching salary couldn't keep up with rising rents. The neighborhood shifted toward more adult-only, work-from-home residents, and she was eventually forced to find a new place to live.
I mean, the Bronx is today incredibly expensive, but still not as expensive as Manhattan. All of Manhattan, including Harlem, it has become impossibly expensive.
Carmen was living in East Flatbush when she began searching for a permanent home. At the time, she was renting, something she said she'd never grown used to since leaving Guyana. She'd rented several places in Brooklyn, but what she really wanted was her own home for her family.
When Carmen initially decided to buy a house, she found one listed for $248,000 that she was going to buy. But when the lawyer handed her the contract, additional fees had pushed the price to more than three times the original amount, a price Carmen could not afford to pay.
I said, sir, you made a mistake on this contract. I said, what you mean? I didn't make a mistake. I said, yes, you did. Because how could a house of $248,000 become this money here?
The median household income by the early 2000s was around $72,000. While the average home price was $1 million in Manhattan and about $251,000 in Brooklyn. That's according to the NYU Furman Center, which conducts research on housing, land use, and urban policy. She'd been going to St. Paul Community Baptist Church since 1991 and had heard about the work they were doing to help people own their homes affordably.
I couldn't afford a home at the beginning. The department head was paying $18,000 a year, and we could barely make ends meet. But I tried saving and trying to buy me a home.
Still searching for a new home, she applied for the church's affordable Nehemiah housing in East New York that her church helped build.
This church would keep us updated about when the next phase of the Nehemiah would come, and they always talked about affordable homes. And I realized that, hey, I couldn't buy a traditional home.
And for Carmen, things were starting to look up for her and her family as they got a new home.
I could have done two times over nine mortgage for the same rent I was paying. So I did the same thing. I was able to pay it off. And the rest is just...
But the housing struggle Carmen once faced has only worsened in New York.
Vicky Bean, co-director of the NYU Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy, agrees that New York City is currently facing its worst housing affordability crisis in decades. Rents and housing prices have climbed far faster than incomes, and the city hasn't built enough housing in the neighborhoods where people want and need to live. As a result, tenants have been facing a rent burden, spending far more than they can reasonably afford, and are experiencing deteriorating housing conditions that have become widespread, often feeding into one another.
Nearly a third of New York City renters spend 50% or more of their income on rent, far above the recommended affordability threshold. The median renter spends around 31% of their income just on housing.
I don't see too many people, and I don't have too many reasons to be hopeful that the city is taking this issue of class seriously enough to really make the existence and the preservation of the New York City that we love a sustainable proposition. It will be New York City. New York City will always exist, but will it be the New York City that the whole world has come to love, admire, look forward to, look up to?
The city's new mayor, Zoran Mamdani, has made housing a central focus of his agenda. He's pushed for efforts to cut red tape, stabilize rents, and explore more cost-efficient ways to build new homes. His administration is also bringing together public agencies, private developers, and nonprofit housing groups to look for long-term collaborative solutions to the city's affordability crisis.
If organizations, individuals, and government can move past small fixes and embrace bold joint action, New York City can set a new standard for affordability and equity in urban life, one that keeps the doors of opportunity open for generations to come.
In the next episode, we stop at churches and mosques in New York City to find out how religion helped liberate Black New Yorkers and continues to be an important cultural center for Black survival in the rapidly changing city.
This is The City Was Black with your host, Haya Panjwani, and me, Jalen Green. This series is produced with guidance from AP Managing Editors Ron Vample and Aaron Morrison. Special thanks to our guests and contributors, Carmen Daniels, Dion Williams, Carmen's daughter, Vicky Bean and the NYU Furman Center, Sarah Seidman and Mancho Lopez from the Museum of the City of New York, and everyone at the Metro Industrial Areas Foundation.
Thanks for listening. From the early days of Mesopotamia in 2500 BCE to modern Hinduism, religion has been a way for people to make sense of the world and share those experiences with those around them.
Comes about from individuals who are looking for meaning, looking for something more, feeling as if there is something more, having a variety of spiritual experiences in their everyday life, and they're trying to make sense of those experiences.
Sometimes religion has been a form of control, forcing enslaved Africans to convert to Christianity. In others, it has turned into a liberating force.
That's why the Exodus narrative becomes such an important narrative for enslaved Black people, because it is a God who sees an oppressed and enslaved Jewish people, liberates them from that oppression.
Now, in the 21st century, religion is evolving into something new that doesn't look like exactly how it did in the past. Hi, I'm Haya Panjwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. Welcome back to The City Was Black, a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the point of view of what it means to be Black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history. And as you'll learn throughout this podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of Black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact Black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City will depend on how Black communities and other minorities survive in the city. Last time we followed Carmen to talk about how rising home prices are pushing Black and brown communities farther from the city.
This episode, we're going to the church that helped Carmen get a home and sit with some of the actors making the church in New York a liberating force for Black New Yorkers, and go to mosques to understand how Islam acts in parallel, sharing Black communities, neighborhoods, and offering an alternative story about who Black people are religiously and politically.
When enslaved Africans arrived with the Dutch in the 1620s, many were pressured to convert to Protestant Christianity of the Reformed Dutch Church.
Some Africans accepted conversion, believing that by joining Dutch religious life, they could sanctify their marriages, baptize their children, and one day seem equal enough to share freedom. Some advocates like Everardus Bogardus, a Dutch Reformed minister, advocated for their spiritual education, an idea welcomed by church elders who saw converted Africans as potentially more trustworthy than their Native American neighbors in the area. By the mid-18th century, a group of equal rights activists called the New York Manumission Society worked with churches to create night schools and African free schools to teach Black children reading and writing. This played a crucial role in the eventual education of newly freed African American children.
Good morning, St. Paul family, St. Paul Nation. Now I'm saying, Salamona, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Amen. Amen.
For generations, Black churches have been more than places of worship. They've been classrooms, community centers, and safe havens, creating community in times of need and nurturing the next generation.
Taking care of the people's needs is John Bassler. So we don't say, this is what the church should do. We say, this is what the church is.
churches also emerged as key organizing hubs, with groups like the Metro Industrial Areas Foundation equipping everyday New Yorkers to unite around local issues rather than relying solely on government action.
Starting with communities, faith communities, judicatories participated, Baptists, you had Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Episcopalians, you had a plethora of religious and denominational expressions. But the point was, is that the people saw their own self-interest in it and realized that we had more in common than we had not in common. So people worked together with a mind to build, and this is how we got here today.
That's Reverend Dr. David K. Brawley, the lead pastor at St. Paul's Community Baptist Church, the church that helped Carmen Daniels secure housing in the previous episode. St. Paul's is one of the many congregations a part of East Brooklyn Congregations that took on a small but urgent issue like fighting for the community's basic needs like street signs and access to unspoiled food. As they won these battles, community leaders realized incremental fixes weren't enough. In the 1970s and early 1980s, they decided to pursue a larger, more transformative goal: build affordable housing. Religion, as civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton calls it, has always been a client relationship where people work with their local assembly member, trading help in their communities for their votes.
Historically, Black church was the largest gathering of Black people in any given Sunday. That was where the majority of Blacks were. And if you were interested in politics, you're going to go where the gatherings are. It is safe to assume that anyone that goes to church with their family usually are voter.
The community banded together to support each other because of how hard it is to maintain basic needs in New York.
It is so easy to become homeless in New York City. Food insecurity in New York City is so prevalent. Until churches have to be engaged in the stability of their community.
Reverend Brian Scott has been pastor at Union Baptist Church in Harlem for 9 years. He's noticed churches invest so much energy in supporting people because of the greater challenges and instability many face in New York's urban environment.
If I were living with someone, we share an apartment. If my name is not on the lease when that person is deceased, say they die all of a sudden, then I become homeless because I can't stay in that apartment anymore.
And throughout the 20th century, many people that went to church found it as a saving grace towards a better future in places like New York.
Like Reverend Dr. Rashad Moore, the pastor of First Baptist Church Crown Heights. He grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant as a product of the Great Migration.
My parents rented this apartment, but the house was built by my church. So I lived in a house that I thought was like the best. And my church was across the street. And the school that I went to was on the next block. And literally, my grandmother lived 2 blocks down. I only say all of this to say, my whole world was in the span of like a 3-block radius.
He told us that for many Black people that didn't grow up with money or privilege, the church acted like a ticket out the hood.
There are thousands of high schools in New York. And when I was going to high school, you get 12 choices. So if you're going to go to a music school, you have to audition, dance, right? If you're smart, there's a specialized high school, right? Or you play basketball, there'll be recruiters, right? So everybody needs a ticket to get out the hood.
And that for him came in the form of learning piano from the pastor's wife, teaching him at a young age to play and sight read just enough to help him get into Brooklyn High School of the Arts. But he noticed that times aren't how they used to be. Moore said that when he came back to New York after graduating from Morehouse College in Atlanta, it had become much more difficult to afford to live in New York City. Even for his friends who had gone to college, many of the friends and loved ones he grew up with moved out because it wasn't as easy to start a life.
And the current generation is struggling to find the same meaning in the church. Many were raised with less religious involvement, juggling work, school, and social lives. Now, they seek spirituality and community in more flexible, personal ways digitally, often outside formal congregations, contributing to a growing number of people who identify as religiously unaffiliated.
Pastors have told us that especially after COVID, church attendance dropped as people stayed home. But as churches move services online, some people reconnected through live streams, virtual Bible studies, and social media. While in-person attendance never fully returned, some pastors say the pandemic opened new doors, service evolving to meet people where they're at, helping people beyond just through religious instruction and teaching religious lessons in ways that resonate with Gen Z and millennials.
Islam is not just a belief system, but a way of life, shaping how they treat others, practice kindness, and move through the world.
It has also been a part of New York City since the early Dutch period, becoming more visible in the 20th century as immigrant communities built the city's first mosques.
Many Black Muslim New Yorkers trace their roots to West and Central Africa, regions that shaped later waves of Muslim immigration into Brooklyn and other boroughs. Harlem in the early 20th century emerged as a cultural center, as Black Muslims from the South and the Caribbean brought distinct religious, political, and cultural traditions.
But for many Black Muslims, discrimination has been at the intersection of their religion and race.
After the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center in New York, the words Muslim and terrorist became intertwined. Many Black Muslims faced discrimination at the intersection of their religion and race.
My mom isn't a hijabi, so we were kind of privileged to not face that. But my dad was visibly, like, you know, brown and Muslim, and he had a job and he had coworkers that treated him different. After that, I really feel like the focus shifted after, like, for a lot of us, after feeling just, like, safe in our country, we kind of started to feel, like, a little unsafe and just scared of what's to come.
That pattern was especially visible during New York's recent mayoral race, where Muslim Mayor Zahran Mamdani faced heightened scrutiny, not just for his policies, but for his faith and identity.
While Muslims share the same core beliefs and practices, many Black Muslims still face discrimination within the faith by non-Black Muslims. That's a treatment rooted in a long history of enslavement and colonialism in parts of the Arab world. It continues today through colorism, stereotypes, and the mistreatment of Black African migrants and refugees, many of whom are Muslim. In our next episode, we'll look into how religious spaces are used to help mobilize groups and how politics and modern political organization has impacted Black communities.
This is The City Was Black with your host, Haya Panjwani, and me, Jalen Green. This series is produced with guidance from AP Managing Editors Ron Vample and Aaron Morrison. Special thanks to our guests and contributors, Trice Prince from the University of Illinois Chicago, Reverend Dr. David K. Brawley and his team at St. Paul's Community Baptist Church, Reverend Al Sharpton and those at the National Action Network, Reverend Brian Scott, Reverend Dr. Rashad Moore, Sarah Seidman from the Museum of the City of New York, those at Masjid Talhid, Abu Bakari, Musa Ducre, Ramada Ducre, and Yara Shabana.
Thanks for listening. After the Emancipation Proclamation freed people from slavery, Black people who lived in or moved to New York City were left virtually hopeless. They lacked money, had little to no formal education, and their families were torn apart. But they had one thing: community. So they gathered.
And if you wanted something done in your community, a mortgage, a streetlight fixed, a voice at City Hall, you didn't just vote. You organized at your community's de facto headquarters, the church.
Hi, I'm Haya Panjwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. Welcome back to The City Was Black, a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the point of view of what it means to be Black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history. And, as you'll learn throughout this podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of Black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact Black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City will depend on how Black communities and other minorities survive in the city. Last episode, we learned about the significance of religion for Black communities in New York City. This time, we look at how Black political power in New York evolved out of church basements and into seats of power at city and state levels.
The only power you had was to convene.
That's Reverend Al Sharpton.
Black Church was our first effort toward coming together. We could congregate, which is why our Black colleges, our Black fraternities, our Black politics all started Black Church, but that's the only thing we had.
He says the church wasn't just about prayer. It also served as a political headquarters.
By the early 1900s, if you wanted Black votes, you went to the church. But Black people didn't have real power yet.
If you had a church and needed a mortgage, it was based on if you could trade with your local assembly, you know, councilman. But you had no power. So it was basically client relationship. We had no real power until the mid to late 50s.
That started changing in 1941, when Adam Clayton Powell Jr. became the first Black person elected to New York City Council. He was the pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem.
Powell led boycotts of stores that wouldn't hire Black workers in the 1940s, 20 years before the Montgomery bus boycott sit-ins down south.
In 1945, he became the second Black person from New York elected to Congress.
By the 60s, a new generation rose up. Percy Sutton, David Dinkins, Charles Rangel, Basil Patterson. They called themselves the Gang of Four. Keisha Sutton James is the deputy Manhattan borough president.
There wasn't any daylight between them, and they just moved in lockstep, which frankly made them incredibly effective. They were able to they were able to amass power because they trusted one another.
They coordinated together. Percy Sutton pushed Rangel to run for Congress, pushed Dinkins to run for mayor. And because of that community and trust in each other, they built real political power.
Fast forward to 1986, Michael Griffith, a young Black man, was chased by a white mob in Howard Beach and killed. Sharpton led marches.
We had very little political power. But by 89, they killed a young man in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. We led marches. We caused a lot of uproar. A lot of whites got in. We elected the first Black mayor, David Dinkins.
It took until 1989, nearly 200 years, to elect the first Black mayor, and then 30 more years to elect the second one.
But today, the landscape has transformed. The city has had two Black mayors, has a Black state attorney general, Black borough presidents, and Black district attorneys.
Here's Sutton James again.
We're in leadership seats across the city and state. Where we are now in terms of our coverage is something that I can't, I think it would blow their minds.
Sharpton gathered all these leaders together and asked, what are we going to do with this power?
Sharpton noticed tension. With more Black leaders came more disagreement. Back then, the Gang of Four moved as one. Today, leaders don't always align.
The Neely case.
In reference to Jordan Neely.
And I jumped out and supported that guy shouldn't have been killed. Well, there were Blacks in office, including the mayor, that said they understood the guy choking and people were afraid of crime. So I think that we've gotten strong enough where we can disagree without being disagreeable.
So where does Black political power go from here?
Eljoy Williams leads the NAACP's New York State Conference. She's looking toward 2030, the next census, the next redistricting.
That we can continue to expand our reach into a legislative and policy space to ensure that the communities that we are in and will build have the resources necessary to thrive. And that means in every aspect, right? That means that the schools that are in our communities have the resources and the staff and all that they need to succeed in order to prepare our children for a thriving future. That ensures that we continue to break those structural barriers for thriving Black communities. That means that we continue to push the envelope on changing our justice system to be more just and less predatory, and not adding additional things to criminalize people for and therefore increase prison population.
Sharpton thinks that there's something that will unite Black politics again.
It's Donald Trump. He is blatantly doing things that is against the interests of the community. So whereas some grieve, and so do I to some degree, on the election of Donald Trump, the movement side of me says he's going to unite us.
Sharpton sees Trump as a perfect enemy that can rally Black communities together because many see his actions against the interests of the Black community.
He hopes this administration will help unite Black political leaders and activists, even if they disagree on other issues, similar to how the civil rights activists united around fighting segregation in places like Birmingham.
From client relationships to the Gang of Four, to the halls of power, to the fight for what comes next. Black politics in New York has always been about building something out of nothing. And that fight is not over.
Next time, entertainment. How, like politics, Black-led music, fashion, dance, and art molded the city. And how it's continuing to shape the culture today.
This is The City Was Black with your hosts, Haya Panjwani, and me, Jalen Green. This series is produced with guidance from AP Managing Editors Ron Vample and Aaron Morrison. Special thanks to our guests, Reverend Al Sharpton, Keisha Sutton James, and L. Joy Williams.
Thanks for listening.
It's 1977. Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards walked out of Studio 54 in Manhattan. They'd been denied entry to the famous nightclub, despite being the masterminds behind some of disco's biggest hits.
So they went back to their apartment and wrote a song you might have heard.
Les Freak became the biggest selling single in Atlantic Records history.
That's the thing about Black creativity. Even when the doors are closed, the art finds a way out.
Hi, I'm Haya Panjwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. Welcome back to The City Was Black, a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the point of view of what it means to be Black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history. And as you'll learn throughout this podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of Black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact Black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City will depend on how Black communities and other minorities survive in the city.
Last episode, we explored how Black political power grew from church basements into the halls of City Hall. This time, we're looking at how Black fashion, music, and entertainment didn't just shape New York, it shaped the world.
I am Aaron Potts, and I am a designer. And I design my collection, which is called A-Potts.
From Questlove to Naomi Osaka, from Janet Jackson to Jill Scott, Potts has dressed everyone. But his journey into fashion started in Detroit.
Detroit is, you know, I think the first thing people think of when they think of Detroit is crime, which growing up there, I don't know what they were looking at. And the other thing that people think of is music. Oh, and also cars. Those are the things. But two of those three things, the cars, the music, it was all rooted in creativity.
He moved to New York in the 90s to study at the Parsons School of Design. And what he found was a city where Black culture and queer culture were driving the creative engine.
It was Black culture and queer culture were like the two predominant creative forces in New York City.
And that culture landed him to find one of his biggest influences, the Black Panthers.
All Black, huge natural afros. They were often wearing like Black fitted pants with a Black fitted turtleneck or a Black fitted top with a Black leather jacket or another Black jacket. They were pretty famous for their black berets that they wore. And they'd have on Black gloves and Black boots or Black shoes. And it was like a sea of all these like beautiful Black people with these huge afros in head to toe Black.
Because for the Black Panthers, fashion wasn't shallow. It was armor.
They had a very keen understanding that the how they physically looked and how they physically were perceived actually spoke to their message. It was not happenstance that they dressed like that. I think it was very intentional, and it walked lockstep with their philosophy.
A philosophy of resistance that made itself known specifically in Harlem, where Black fashion originated from expression through clothing. It wasn't just about looking your best, but expressing yourself through the structure of modern fashion to show a strength that blared loud even when their words were not heard.
And in the early 90s, another movement was growing, the ballroom scene.
You might know it from the documentary Paris is Burning, or shows like Pose. But back then, it was happening in underground clubs across the city.
That was when I first got here, Paris is Burning, which is, I would say, one of the most important documentaries ever made, was released like a year after I got here. That was such a, I would say, almost like a microcosm of the, like showing how influence sort of like, it starts in these little dark places where people are often marginalized, and they go into these secluded places to be able to express and create based on their whatever their culture is.
Potts remembers seeing RuPaul before Supermodel and Drag Race, just dancing on boxes in Union Square.
Started to see how those people influence people, because what was happening is you started getting, you know, a model or a photographer or an art director, or someone would go to a ball or go see Paris is Burning or hang out with someone, or they saw them on the pier. And those ideas then start to snowball. And what ends up happening is that the ideas get big and the people who create it get left behind.
Left behind indeed, from streetwear fashion to jazz to garage house music.
It's a pattern that repeats itself again and again. Black and queer communities create, the mainstream appropriates, the creators forgotten.
But Potts was lucky. When he got to New York, there was a generation of Black designers who made space for young creatives like him.
There was a generation of Black fashion designers in New York City when I got here. Isaiah Rankin, Michael McCollum, Patrick Kelly, Jeffrey Banks is like old school. I was able to see these people, see them working, seeing how they experienced New York City, and I was so lucky that I actually got to meet them and sort of fold myself into their circle.
Those designers, along with legends like Andre Leon Talley, created what Potts calls a secondary fashion culture,
where they could step into the mainstream, but then always fall back on what they created.
Fashion and music in New York, they've always fed each other, and no movement made that clearer than hip-hop.
I would say hip-hop has probably been the single biggest inspiration for fashion and almost every creative expression. Fashion, music, even dance to a large degree.
Michael Kilgore is a Grammy-nominated R&B singer and Broadway actor. He's been in New York for 20 years, and he's watched the city's creative landscape shift.
I am an R&B singer-songwriter. Also, I am a theater performer in New York City, a Broadway actor.
When Kilgore first got to New York in the early 2000s, the city still had physical spaces where Black music thrived.
The place is called Village Underground. It was like the open mic in New York City. Cheryl Pepsi Riley used to host. You could go in one night and all of a sudden Prince would be there performing. There was kind of a feeling of like, you could be found there. You could be discovered. You could grow a fan base there.
New York had places like that where you could be discovered, where you could build a fan base. And over time, those spaces disappeared.
Just like everything else in the city, all the cool stuff is now being pushed to the edges of the city. I think it's because it's too expensive. I think that the city is like impossible, especially for Black and brown people, to have comfortable, fun, like easy breezy lives in Manhattan.
As rents rose, the clubs moved to the margins like the Bronx and Brooklyn. But something else happened too. The internet changed everything.
You know, there was like destinations to showcase yourself. And, you know, because of the world changing, the internet, you have to make your own destination. You don't have to depend on a venue on a set night when you have this like new virtual world. The venue is as large as your phone.
But even as the city has changed, one thing remains constant. The intersection of Blackness through self-expression continues to drive New York's creative culture.
I think that Blackness and queerness, especially when the arts are concerned, are kind of linked, not especially, but specifically in this New York conversation. You know, I think it's kind of true everywhere, but in this New York conversation, I think there are a lot of genres that are exploding now because of the openness of like young queer folk, superstars like the Lil Nas X's and the Billy Porters and the Victoria Monets of the world who are pretty open and unashamed about their queerness.
Club culture is changing too. It It's not just hip hop anymore.
It's like dance culture. It's, you know, there is an opening in Black queer spaces now for them to put their stamp on the art that's being made.
And Kilgore sees a pattern in history. When the world gets darker, the art gets brighter.
It was like, you know, it's pretty historic that when the regime is most oppressive, queer spaces are most liberated. And the queer spaces I tend to spend my time in are Black queer spaces. And I think the music, the art is representative of that.
We asked both Potts and Kilgore about the future, and both of them wrestled between hope and fear.
I have thoughts and ideas and wishes for what I want for Black designers. I don't know, in this crazy world where we're now scared of free speech, you know, I don't know what that means for, I mean, I know what that means for Black people in America because we've been there. That scares me. So I wrestle often with this hope for free creative expression. But then there's another part of me that's, how do I balance that if we can't even speak freely?
Potts wants Black designers to get the same support, the same resources, the same opportunities as their white counterparts. He wants recognition for the work they've put in.
You know, I would just hope that myself included, but so many of my peers that have put in the work, have studied and made people literally billions of dollars, brought ideas to the table that no one remembers that you brought it, you know? I would hope that all of us can actually reap the benefits of what we actually put in.
But even with uncertainty, Potts finds refuge in his work.
When I'm feeling stressed, when I'm feeling sort of distraught and a little hopeless, going into my creativity is actually the saving grace.
And Kilgore is thinking about ownership.
Really, it's about who owns the space. Whoever owns the space gets to decide what the story is. They get to decide who's popular, who's in the front.
He wants Black art to be more than something to admire from a distance.
So I want, you know, Black art to, you know, of course be celebrated and venerated, but I also want it to be used in the way that it's meant to be used. So
Anne believes that no matter how much people try to ignore it, the truth will become undeniable.
We're gonna have to reconcile that Black music is American music in good and bad ways. It's gonna be really difficult. The stuff that we have said is not Black, well, it actually is.
From the creation of hip hop to the ballroom stages of Harlem, from Village Underground to the edges of Brooklyn, Black fashion and music in New York have never just been about entertainment.
They've been about survival, about joy, about creating something beautiful in a world that doesn't always make space for you.
Next time on The City Was Black, education. How Black students and educators have fought for a seat at the table, and how the city's schools still struggle to deliver on the promise of equal education.
This is The City Was Black with your hosts, Haya Panjwani, and me, Jalen Green. This series is produced with guidance from AP Managing Editors Ron Vample and Aaron Morrison. Special thanks to our guests, Aaron Potts and Michael Kilgore.
Thanks for listening. For more on the AP's race and ethnicity coverage, visit apnews.com.
The education of Black children has been a priority of enslaved Africans since they first arrived in New York City.
Education for enslaved Africans meant freedom both to escape enslavement and to provide practical and literary skills to have more leverage in surviving the colonial environment.
A report from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA shows the New York public school system is facing one of the largest education disparities in the nation, where child preparation is deeply unequal, and many wealthy, majority white areas benefit from having far greater financial resources.
Hi, I'm Haya Panjwani.
And I'm Jalen Green. The City Was Black is a six-part audio series exploring what it means to live in New York.
And how the city has evolved through the point of view of what it means to be Black in New York City right now.
We're at a critical point in New York history,
And as you'll learn throughout the podcast, the city would not be the rich melting pot of cultures it is right now without the contributions of Black people.
There isn't a single issue in the city right now that doesn't impact Black people, whether that's immigration, housing, or education. The future of New York City will depend on how Black communities and other minorities survive in the city.
Last episode, we talked about how Black-led music, fashion, dance, and art molded the city, and how it still shapes the culture today. This time, we're talking about how the traditional school setting has not been equipped to deal with all the challenges these students are facing today. Black children began learning in the early Dutch periods when African free schools were made.
As time went by, more schools were popped up, with the first African free school in Brooklyn opening in 1827. These schools operated separately from what later became the New York City public school system. And by the mid-1800s, African free schools joined the fold.
But Black and brown students were still separated into schools with less resources.
By the mid-1900s, the Federal Housing Authority reinforced residential segregation through redlining, a practice that systemically graded neighborhoods on a scale with lower ratings given to communities with higher shares of Black and brown residents.
Aaron Palace is a professor of sociology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University.
New York City historically has been highly segregated residentially, both along racial and ethnic lines and social class lines. And what that meant is that there's a lot of segregation across the 32 community school districts by race, ethnicity, and social class. But even within the 32 community school districts, there can be a fair amount of segregation across the schools at the elementary and middle school level in particular.
After Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, it took a long time for schools throughout the country to actually start school districts that actively desegregated.
In New York, many Black and Puerto Rican students experience overcrowded schools with more substitutes, inexperienced teachers, and lower academic outcomes. In the spring of 1968, Black and Puerto Rican parents organized strikes for better schools for their children.
Organizations such as the Alliance for Quality Education, or AQE, formed to protect the equal rights children have towards education by training parents to take these concerns to the state level.
In 1993, a lawsuit brought by parents argued that New York State schools' financing system was unconstitutional because it severely underfunded New York City public schools and denied students their constitutional right to a sound basic education.
Julia Watson is the communications director for AQE.
But in 2006, they sided with the parents who had filed that lawsuit, said, yeah, no, the state needs to fund public schools at a certain level in order for kids to have their constitutional right to an education be met. And then the recession happened, of course, not long thereafter. So there was a commitment to funding schools, and then that commitment just fell by the wayside.
Now in present day, schools are still segregated, and this is affecting people like teachers. Sydney King has been teaching at South Brooklyn Community High School for 24 years.
My goal is always to try and interrupt the cycles that bring them here.
Can you explain what that means?
So they often will write their stories and they'll complain about the teachers who didn't care, right? I get paid whether you learn or not. So I've been listening to that story for 23 years and I just want to keep being the teacher that cares no matter what, to interrupt that story they tell themselves.
Because of the area's lack of adequate resources, both inside and outside of school, many Black and brown students lack. And students in low-income neighborhoods are bringing high levels of trauma and financial stress with them, affecting their ability to learn.
And when educators aren't seeing these needs, it's only pushing children further behind.
You have no idea when you meet a kid what their future is going to be. And it doesn't have a pattern. And there's kids that drive me crazy and miss school for a year or 2 years, and then all of a sudden they have an epiphany and they come back and they're working super hard. They're my best student now. And I see that so often. And everybody has their own life. And I think the thing that we do so much is try and over-control teenagers.
Community boards hold meetings to address these challenges, working to support children and help connect them with the resources they need to access strong educational opportunities, including college.
Good Shepherd Services in New York is a nonprofit that supports young people and families in under-resourced neighborhoods through education,
youth development, and family support programs.
Traquan Becca is the director of career connections at Good Shepherd Services. He attended South Brooklyn and told us about the program they have with mentorship and internship.
Which a lot of the students don't come to school because of because they have to work, right? So, you know, how do we, like Rachel said, how do we engage them to come? I think another layer of it is really just making sure that, you know, we are. It's not only the fact that they have struggles gaining employment or choosing employment over school, right? It's also, do they have the skills, right, to sustain the work? And the Learn to Work program is not only providing jobs, but it's also like doing that wraparound work to where we're teaching skills, right?
But more work needs to be done.
To recap, Black people have been in New York since the early Dutch period, turning their struggle into a strong community that lies the foundation of what makes New York what it is today. Building communities that brought culture across five boroughs despite displacement, racism, and erasure.
We followed Carmen Daniels, who moved from Guyana to New York in the 1980s and learned about her struggle to find housing in one of the most expensive cities.
Went to churches and mosques to talk to religious leaders about how faith institutions in New York had provided community and survival strategies in the face of displacement and economic instability.
Learned how the rise of Black political power grew out of church basements and community organizing into lasting influence at the city and state level.
Heard how Black dance, art, and fashion shaped the cultural narratives of the city and the world.
And saw how the fight for Black education began during the early Dutch period and continues to be a fight for equal resources and providing brighter futures for their children.
The problems that face Black people are felt amongst the many kinds of people in the city. And Black people are but one of the many lenses by which to understand how New York became what it is today.
As the city continues to evolve, it'll be based on how communities, old and new, can work together to combat the many challenges the city has in building a brighter future.
This is The City Was Black with your host, Haya Punjwani, and me, Jalen Green. This series is produced with guidance from AP Managing Editors Ron Vample and Aaron Morrison. Special thanks to our guests and contributors, Aaron Palace, Catherine Hill with the Research Alliance for New York City Schools, Sydney King and the faculty and staff at South Brooklyn Community High School, Traquan Becca, Rachel Forsyth, and all those at Good Shepherd Services, and Julia Watson with the Alliance for Equality Education.
Thanks for listening. For more stories about race and ethnicity, visit apnews.com.
I'm Terry Lipschitz, thanking you for listening. Audio provided by the Associated Press. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.